So page 271, it's 1 Samuel in the Bible. New series we start today in the Old Testament. And we're going to look at this first chapter of 1 Samuel today. We're going to read verses 1 to 14 today. In fact, no, we're going to go to 16. And Felicity is going to come and read it for us. So chapter 1, page 271, 1 Samuel, verses 1 to 16.
There was a man from Ramathaim, a Zuphite, from the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, son of Yeroham, son of Elihu, son of Tahu, son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. He had two wives. One was called Hannah, and the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had none. Year after year, this man went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh, where Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord. Whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to his wife Peninnah and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion, because he loved her, and the Lord had closed her womb. Because the Lord had closed Hannah's womb, her rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. This went on year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her till she wept and would not eat. Her husband Elkanah would say to her, "Hannah, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why are you downhearted? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons? Once when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on his chair by the doorpost of the Lord's house. In her deep anguish, Hannah prayed to the Lord, weeping bitterly. And she made a vow, saying, "Lord Almighty, if you will only look on your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head." As she kept on praying to the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying in her heart, and her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk, and said to her, "How long are you going to stay drunk? Put away your wine." "Not so, my lord," Hannah replied. "I am a woman who is deeply troubled. I have not been drinking wine or beer. I was pouring out my soul to the Lord. Do not take your servant for a wicked woman. I have been praying here out of my great anguish and grief."
Thanks, Felicity. Please keep your Bibles open as we look at this passage together. Look at this first chapter in Samuel together. Keep it open there on page 291. I've been thinking a little bit about saints this week. Coming up next Monday, not tomorrow, but next Monday, St. Bridget's Day, which we've all been gifted ourselves, an extra bank holiday, how kind of us. Got me thinking about St. Bridget. I was thinking about saints just generally this week. Bridget, right about the 6th century, an Irish woman from up somewhere around the Dundalk area, I think, is where she's from. And she is recognized, she's remembered because she was one of the first people to start a monastery in Ireland. She started a monastery that first had nuns in it and then had monks in it as well. So kinds of things that go with her, including a story about turning water into beer. Sounds sort of familiar, right? She turned water into beer. She managed to feed 18 churches with one casket of water, turned that into beer, and she'd not feed them, but give them enough beer, apparently. I mean, that's what the myths say. And I was thinking about these people. If you look up saints and you think about the people who got recognized officially, I suppose, by the Catholic Church as being in somehow standout. And if you read about them, you hear about all sorts of things. St. Patrick, obviously, who brought Christianity to Ireland. Others who carried important documents in the 16th century across dangerous Europe at tumultuous times. And they're considered to be people who stood out in faith. And it's interesting, for mostly those who were not Catholic, those who were part of the Reformation, chose not to canonize people or have saints that were set apart. And I suppose the reason is that there is a sense that what we're going to see as we see 1 Samuel, that really there is no person who's faithful to God who stands out. That those who are followers of God actually in their needs are equal. Actually in their need for God, that there isn't anybody who gets to say, "I am particularly set apart other than anybody else." And we're going to see that as we look at this book of 1 Samuel, which is where we're starting today. There's all sorts of things that come up in this book that we're going to see, things to do with leadership. Lots of people lead in some way or other. Most people lead in some way or another, maybe in work, maybe in an organization, maybe in the home. And questions to do with what kind of leader are you going to emerge from this book? And maybe even more importantly, what kind of leaders do you follow? Who influences you? Why do you follow those people? And what difference does it make in your life? All of these things are things that come up in this. What we find in 1 and 2 Samuel is that God's people go from having no king to having a king. Up to this point, there's been no kind of monarchy among God's people. And this is the book, 1 Samuel, where the first king emerges. Really, it focuses on three people. First of all, Samuel, who's not a king, then the first king, who's Saul, and then David, who's the second king, and in some sense, maybe the most important or noteworthy of all of the kings that we read about in the Bible. The way the Bible's the way it's made up is kind of important for this. You'll see on the left-hand side of this page, you'll see that Ruth ends and Samuel begins. Can you see that? Now, if you flip back to me for three pages, 266, go back to 266. Now, in our Bibles, Ruth comes between Judges and 1 Samuel, okay? But in the Hebrew scriptures, Ruth was actually placed somewhere else. Ruth is funny because it doesn't follow the chronology that goes, but it's just before David, and it's an important book in the line of David, and it's important for other reasons. And so the Hebrew scriptures put it in, really among its kind of prophetic, its poetic writings. It was in a different place. But the Christians decided when they were putting the Bible together to put it here because Ruth was so important in the lineage of David and in the lineage of Jesus as well. But actually how the narrative went in the Hebrew text was it finished like this. Judges chapter 21, verse 25, it says, "In those days Israel had no king, everyone did as they saw fit." Do you remember when the teacher left the classroom? Just be quiet, everybody, while I go out for 5 minutes. And if they were gone for 5 minutes, everyone did as they saw fit. Some people sat and did their work like they're supposed to do. Other people get in the corner and get the old mobile phones out and do whatever they want to do on their mobile phones. Others start throwing things around the classroom. And the sense is that among God's people, it was a classroom with no teacher in it. People are just doing whatever they want. Everybody did what was right in their own eyes. They just did whatever they saw fit. They did whatever. There was no leadership. God's people are in a particularly bad place here. They've been led by a group of people called judges who've been appointed one after another. Some of the judges are kind of godly. You've got people like Gideon sort of stands out. People like Samson, they stand out. But for the most part, God's people were not listening to what God had to say and had nothing to do with what God was asking them to do in their lives. So we come to this, we come to Samuel, understanding that there was some sort of crisis of leadership in the background in all of this. And it's going to be a very important book. If you were asked in a quiz, other than Jesus, God, who is named in the first paragraph of the New Testament, so 1,000 years later than the events recorded in this book, 1,000 years later, somebody is mentioned in the first paragraph of the New Testament and the last paragraph of the New Testament. We care to take a guess? David. Oh, Abraham's good guess. He's in the last, but not the first. David. David is named in the first and last. It's interesting, he's named in the very last paragraph in Revelation chapter 21 at verse 16. Speaking, Jesus says, "I am the root and the offspring of David." I'm the root and offspring of David. That's a very strange thing to say, by the way. He says, "I'm a descendant of David, and I'm also his origin." David was so important to the people of God that he's mentioned all the way through, and so much references to, there's so many references to him. And yet Jesus is the one who is his origin. He is the creator of all people and all things. He came to the earth, and that's why he's the offspring of David, but he is the king over all things. That's going to be an important theme that comes up in 1 Samuel. Israel moves in this time from a theocracy, having God as the king, to a monarchy with the establishment of essentially hereditary kings in it. Now, there's a theme that runs through all of this. Chapter 8 gives it to us. Why don't you turn to page 278? Really important theme that runs through 1 Samuel. What we're going to see is that the kingdom is established in Israel. And at chapter 8, verse 7, page 278, what's happening is Samuel has got old, and the people are saying, "Give us a king to lead us." And Samuel's not happy. He's been the priest. He's been the one who's been leading them to God. He's been doing a great job on that. And the people are like, "Give us a king. We want a king. Everybody else has a king. Give us one of these great leaders who stands up in front of us." And Samuel's not happy. He's like, "But what about me? What kind of job have I done?" But God says this, and the Lord told him, "Listen to all that the people are saying. It's not you they've rejected in asking for a king, but they have rejected me as their king." So the people are going to want the king, but what God says about that is a rejection of me. The fact that they want to have this human leader in place is a rejection of my leadership. Now God gives them a king. He allows them to have a king. And there's going to be all sorts of complexity in this book, First Samuel. It's not all clear and grey and black and white. There's all sorts of stuff that goes on here. And one of the questions that arises, well, why does God give them something that he knows that isn't good for them? He gives them what they ask for. And we're going to see that God is going to be faithful, working in his grace, despite the people wanting this king in this way. The thing that is really striking about First Samuel, and I'm saying this to the kids, is that it's really messy. There's greed, there's envy, there's lust, there's murder, there's deception, and that's the good people in the book. It really is messy and it's complicated in all of this. And Macbeth is a classic book. Get a little bit of shakes thinking about school, thinking about Macbeth. And Macbeth is a study really by Shakespeare of what happens when somebody is greedy for power. You've got Macbeth and he wants to become the king of Scotland. And he and his wife will do whatever it takes to get themselves in power. And there is a sense that some of what Shakespeare had in mind was King Saul, the first king of God's people in this. This just wanting power against all odds, against everything. He just wants to take power and hold on to it and not do as God says. So we're going to see all of that in the book of 1 Samuel. And it's worth asking ourselves, or noting as we come to it, is asking ourselves, why does this book not start at chapter 3? There are going to be three key characters, Samuel, Saul, and David. And a very natural start for 1 Samuel is chapter 3. You could start by saying, on page 273, there was a boy called Samuel, and he ministered before the Lord under Eli. You could have started with the first of these three characters. But God in his goodness and his kindness has given us two chapters before this, which is in a sense the backstory to Samuel being born. Why do we get this story about this woman called Hannah? Why is it there? Well, I hope that emerges as we look at this. We start this book with a man with no particular significance at all. It says at the beginning, there was a certain man from Ramathaim, a Zophite from the hill country of Ephraim. And if that means nothing to you, don't worry, it meant very little to people at the time either. This is not somebody who's been born in one of the great cities of the world. This is not Paris. This is not London. It's not even Dublin. I've always given Leitrim a hard time. We'll be kind to Leitrim. Somebody has got a Leitrim connection, and I got told that once. But this is a nowhere place. This is a nowhere man who's got no credentials as far as humans go. And that's what we're going to see. That God uses people who are not anything by great human standards. One of the great themes of this book is going to be God is a king who's not impressed by palaces, and he invites you into his kingdom. God is a king who's not impressed by human standards, and he invites you into his eternal kingdom. That's going to be a big theme of all of this. So we start with this man called Elkanah, and we note that his background, he's got no great history or anything like that. He's just any old person. What we do hear about him is that he's a man who's got two wives. Or to put it in more modern times, he's a man with two durable relationships at home. If you don't get that reference, you need to be more in touch with Irish politics and a referendum that's coming on the 6th of March. He's got two durable relationships at home. And he's got these two wives. And what we see about this is it's really awkward and at home. And there's polygamy, people with multiple wives appear in the Bible. At no point does the Bible say it's okay. But here, the narrator just describes it. And what's described is really the awkwardness, the terribleness of what it might be to have two spouses at home. Not just trying to remember two birthdays or two anniversaries, but the tensions that exist. And we see that one of these women, Penina, really is, as I was saying earlier, a piece of work. The story is that she's got children and Hannah doesn't. And it's hard in normal circumstances to be somebody who has this burden on you, somebody who wants to have children and who hasn't been able to have children. But what's added on top of that is this Hannah is living in a home with Elkanah, this woman Penina, and she's got children. She has what Hannah wants to have. And not only has she got children, she's not nice about it at all. And the strains that go with that. So what we read is that they go to Shiloh. And I think one of the things that when we read 1 Samuel is, we're supposed to see ourselves in some way in the text. And it could well be that you don't have this exact problem or this issue. You may well have. But you may have lived with somebody who is hard to live with. You may live with somebody now who's very difficult to live with. takes everything, don't look at anybody else. and you need the grace to get through the day. Get a sense of that. Loved sharing a house when I was in college. We were a little bit mean to each other. In college, my friend who lived in the house, he wasn't good at doing the dishes. And after a while, instead of doing them for them, put them away from him, we just put them on his bed. Just put his dirty dishes on his bed. He went away for a weekend. He was representing one of the Christian unions, actually. And he went away and he ended up there with a girl on that weekend. She was representing the Christian union. And we decided they would be a great couple. They didn't seem to think it would. So we changed her number in his phone to my number. And so I sent him texts all week from that girl, right? in a hope to get something going, but he just wouldn't bite. So people can be mean and nasty to each other in the house, but not. This is a special level. Special level of nastiness in there. We read that Elkanah is a good man. They go up every year and they go to sacrifice their animals, and one of the acts of sacrificing animals was to, don't be getting ideas, by the way, back there. is to sacrifice animals, and then you got to eat something of it. And there's a funny phrase in there about how Hannah got a double portion. Hard to translate that, but really what I was saying was that Elkanah didn't, he really loved her. He really cared for her. He didn't treat her any differently. He even says when she's weeping over not being able to have children, am I not worth more than this to you? Well, maybe if you'd chosen not to have another wife or one who's so mean, maybe it would be different. But she goes, and this Penina, we read it verse six. Because the Lord had closed Hannah's womb, her rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. So Hannah is living with this. When they're going to worship, this woman is saying to her, you can almost imagine what she's saying. Why are you so happy in worship? God hasn't given you any children. How can you approach God at all? Look what I have that you don't have. Look, you're clearly second rate. You're something else. And Hannah is really upset about this. Of course she is. What have you got to be happy about is the sense in all of this. There's an everyday cruelty and pain in all of this. Year after year, we hear that this is happening. Hannah lives with this all of the time. But then at verse 9, we get a particular scene. They go back up to this place called Shiloh, where they did this, where they had these sacrifices. And it tells us there that what happens is, after eating and drinking at this place, Shiloh, Hannah stands up. There's a priest there called Eli. He's sitting in his chair by the doorpost. And we read that Hannah cries out to God. Eli, the priest, has absolutely no idea what's going on. Such is the low place, actually, of God in people's lives, even the priests, that this priest doesn't even recognize a heartfelt prayer, that somebody would cry out to God and speak to God like this. She says at verse 16, she says that I've been praying here out of my great anguish and my grief. So in such pain, she can barely eat, this woman Hannah. She's crying out to God. And then what we read is they go back home to Ramah. We read that she and Elkanah make love, and Hannah becomes pregnant a little bit later. And then she goes back to Eli. She calls this child Samuel. She goes back to Eli and she presents him to God just as she said she would. So what are we to make of this? How are we to think about why this is here? What God is saying to us through this? And the question is that, well, why start here and not at chapter 3? Why give this story, this account of this woman Hannah, who's just this terrible situation? And I think the first thing is this, and this is going to run the whole way through, is this, that we should have the deepest suspicion and mistrust of human achievement. So we get these people who are absolutely nobodies. And what we see is that God is going to use them in the most important way, because Samuel is going to be an incredibly important figure in the whole history of God's people, in the bringing of the Savior into the world. And he starts in a no-way place. And our world is so set up, it's so oriented for success. It's so oriented for performance, for measurement of how we're doing compared to other people. What's our status? How many friends do we have? How many followers or likes on social media? That's all just been condensed in social media to a very intense way like that. But it's what we do, isn't it? We say to ourselves, well, how am I doing? And I've got to this stage in life and I should have had this job by this stage, or I should have had this achievement. And that is how the world is set up around us. And what happens when we read the Bible is we see God coming into that and saying, that's not how we judge ourselves. God is not at all impressed by strength and human achievement. In fact, there is a mocking of human achievement all the way through 1 Samuel. like a mocking of it. This starting with this woman who's a nobody, who can't have children, and she becomes such an important part of this story. It is essentially mocking that idea that God might only work through those who got success as the world sees us. Why do we keep reading in the Bible about women who can't have children? That comes up again and again. You see the parallels with Elizabeth, who was Mary's cousin that we read about at Christmas time. She also couldn't have, she was an older woman who couldn't have children. And again, it's God saying, I can do what I please. I will use who I choose to use. It's the story about God working through even the human weakness that we see around us. And what about those things that you consider to be the powers that you're aiming for? Whether it's promotion or wealth or some sort of skill, a progress and achievement. What needs in your mind and your heart to have a little knocking over? What's the thing that you feel, I'll be somebody if I achieve that? Be wary and suspicious of anything that you suddenly think, I've made it. Be wary of yourself. If God chooses not to rely on capable humans, then you shouldn't either. Even if that capable human is yourself. That's the first thing, be suspicious of human achievement. The second is this, is the cry of anguish at the human heart. We are, as people, broken. Every person experiences that brokenness and that vulnerability in some way. It might be in your mind, it might be in your body, it might be in your relationships. You experience it every day. Sometimes we get the head down and we can avoid it. But what runs right through the narrative of the Bible is the brokenness of people. And we share that in common. Our hurts and our pains. All of us are going to die. We've been looking at Ecclesiastes in our home group. And great, the first study is something else. You really read through the first 11 chapters of Ecclesiastes and you're like, oh dear. Everything meaningless. Utterly meaningless. Solomon's like, I've got all this stuff and guess what? Didn't make me happy. I had all the pleasure and all the wealth and all the things I dreamed for and guess what? Nothingness. Pure and utterly. You're like, well, really, this is great fun for a Tuesday night. And I mean, and the conclusion is that all of these things are given to us, that when we get a taste of them, they don't fulfill us, is that we were made for something more. And the conclusion in chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes is, remember God in your youth. Start well. Know from very early on, those things are going to let you down. Your brokenness is going to be evident. You're going to have a cry of the human heart, and cries of the human heart are to be directed at God. And Hannah is transformed. She's transformed when she cries out to God. She's transformed in her anguish. She doesn't yet even know that she's going to be pregnant, but she prays to God. Eli responds positively to her, and she goes away totally changed. Go in peace, it says at verse 17. She said, may your servant find favor in your eyes. Then she went her way. She went her way and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. An encounter with God changes us. It puts us on a sure footing. Doesn't mean that everything is going to be perfect, but God heals our brokennesses. He puts us in a place that can't be shaken. He gives us himself. He is the one who's king in our lives. And we see that God is powerfully present in all the situations, even in the worst of them. And the religious people really were not impressive at the time. Eli is sitting at a door. He doesn't even recognize a heartfelt prayer from this woman who's come to pray. Doesn't even know what it is. Thinks she's drunk. Doesn't even know what it is. And maybe our lives before God are a little bit like that. We can give ourselves a religious title or name. I'm a Christian. Go to church. But we could be sitting at the door of the house of God, really not recognizing the work or the activity of God. And this is a judgment on the religious leaders of the time. That they're miles from God. Later we hear that at that time, the word of God was not heard very often. That's because the people weren't ready to hear it and didn't want to hear it. And along comes this woman in this pain and this terrible household situation crying out to God. And God transforms her. So whoever you are, you're invited to come and powerfully, powerfully encounter the living God in the midst of those situations, even the most vulnerable and difficult ones. You might not know this, but Liverpool's manager announced that he's resigning at the end of the season. Might have registered in my world. I didn't cry, not like when Kenny Dalglish left in 1990. I literally cried as a nine-year-old when I heard that. And one of the things, people are talking about Jurgen Klopp, and it's lovely, and it's lovely to hear about how he deals with people. He's not probably everybody's cup of tea, but I genuinely think he's a person who thinks well, thinks about things. And the thing that you often don't hear is that Jurgen Klopp is a very committed Christian. Very committed Christian. Loves Jesus. And I love this quote from him. Oh, my quote. Oh, where have I put it, Darren? Ah, there we go. Jurgen Klopp talks about it. He says to be a believer, but not to want to talk about it. I do not know how it would work. When I look at me and my life, and I take time for that every day, he says, then I feel I am in sensationally good hands. And that is the message of 1 Samuel. That the people of God are in sensationally good hands. The hands are not Eli the priest. The hands are not Saul, who's going to be the first king, or even David, the second king, whose name is a king after God's own heart. The people of God are in the hands of the king himself, of the creator of all things. That's whose hands we're in. We're in the God who cares for us, who's faithful to us, who works in the middle of our brokenness, and through his son Jesus puts us back together again. And that is news that transforms us from the inside out. That is not some pie in the sky, but we look back and we see that God came in the flesh. And by his hands came, by his crucified hands, he died for our sake, so that we could be alive, so that we could be free, so that we didn't need to rely on human leaders, so we didn't need to rely on ourselves. Let's pray and ask that we would live in the hands of the living God.